Good morning. The House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division is called to order. I'm State Representative Dave Pinto, the chair of the division, and I want to welcome members and staff, as well as members of the public who are watching online. I want to give a special welcome to a guest we have on, Senator Karen Housley. And I'm very glad to have her join us as well. I'm sure we'll have some discussion later with her. Reminder, this hearing is being conducted pursuant to House Rule 10.01, allowing for remote committee hearings. And just a reminder to members and presenters to keep themselves muted except for when you're speaking, just in order to preserve sound quality. And we'll have you be recognized by raising your hand or otherwise indicating and going through the chair as usual. And then that there are committee packets, both that have been sent to members and then to members of the public. They've been posted on our committee website, and you can access them there. There's a number of items, and again, I know that we'll be getting to those. We're going to start as usual, though, with the roll call, and so we'll have the clerk please take the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Katiza-Watoon, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Bonner.
Present.
Representative Damuth.
Present.
Representative Heintzman.
Present.
Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Pryor.
Present.
Representative Wasilek.
Present.
Representative West.
Present. Present.
Okay, we do have a quorum. So members are going to start just with some introductory comments, a little bit more than I typically have done at other meetings, just to kind of set the stage, because this is a meeting with a particular focus. So just a reminder to you that we've had a series of hearings and meetings and presentations with a pretty clear message. This is throughout the 2019 session. We had a joint hearing with the Jobs Committee in St. Cloud during that session. We had another joint hearing with the Jobs Committee in Winona in the fall, repeated hearings of the 2020 session. We received reports, et cetera, with a really clear message, which is that early care and learning was in crisis even before the pandemic. And then it continues to be in a deep crisis, of course, through the pandemic as well. We know that providers are being paid so little that nearly half are on public assistance, and that we are losing them at a rapid rate and losing opportunities for care. We know that parents are paying a huge proportion of their income when they can find care at all. And this is having a significant impact on our economic development and our societal development. The opportunity gaps that start long before kindergarten, as we're aware. And then just in the short run, parents not being able to work, employers not being able to hire, and communities not being able to expand. And again, we've heard this at so many hearings and so often in this committee. And of course, then the pandemic, as we've also heard, has made the situation even worse. And again, we've heard much testimony on that, and that adequately supporting childcare is going to be fundamental, is going to be essential for us to have an economic recovery and to move on. So we've, again, heard this so much. The purpose of this hearing is to reexamine one particular way to help the situation, which is to raise the rates for our Child Care Assistance Program, or CCAP. And it's just a reminder of the background that there's a national standard that child care providers be paid the 75th percentile of a survey that is taken every 3 years. So go down in the survey 25 slots, and that 75th percentile is the rate that is set. Now, there's a new requirement that the Trump administration has put in that there be a minimum to have the 25th percentile of current rates be the level paid. We in our state are paying at the 25th percentile of the 2011 rates, nearly 10 years out of date, way behind almost every other state. There's federal funding available to accomplish this. And the failure to do so, in fact, is going to lead to a federal penalty. And of course, there's a moral and societal penalty by not raising rates and supporting our providers and our parents and kids. So a reminder, members, that during the 2020 session, we'd been moving in the House towards a significant increase in CCAP rates via House File 1. That was before the pandemic. After the pandemic, we did still advance a proposal to set rates in the 25th percentile of the current survey. So that's that minimum requirement. We were not able to make progress on that. We now have this upcoming special session, which is really, in my view and the view of many of us, absolutely time to act. And so the agenda for today is to review the federal requirement and the available federal funds to meet it, to review some proposals relating to this with a particular focus on the fiscal implications and the compliance with federal requirements. And again, we've heard so often from parents and providers about the need for this. I did not want to have that have us do that again this morning. I sure hope every member of this committee, I know Senator Housley and her colleagues have heard this so much. We want to do is dive into the nuts and bolts of this and understand the fiscal implications. Rather than the why that's needed. So we're going to start off with a presentation from DHS on the federal requirements and the funds that are available, including the administration's proposal to have increased rates to the 30th percentile as we're trying to make sure that our providers are being paid decently and that parents are receiving support too. So with that, I'm going to have Lisa Bailey, Deputy Assistant Commissioner, please begin. You can maybe just, again, identify yourself for the record as I just did, and then please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Housley, and to staff, thank you for this opportunity to come talk about this important ongoing question. I'm the Deputy Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at DHS, and that is the administration area that oversees the Child Care Assistance Program. As this body is well aware, federal government requires that states reset the rates at which child care CCAP providers are reimbursed at least every 3 years. Federal law also requires that those those rates are set at least the 25th percentile of the most recent market rate survey. Because Minnesota is not in compliance with that requirement, we are subject at the moment to a penalty that would be effective September 30th of 2020. And that's why we have come back to you again this year to ask for consideration of resetting those rates. The last time that the rates were set was back in 2014, which is part of the reason why we are out of compliance. What I'd like to do is turn it over first to the DHS budget director, Dave Greenman, so that he can describe and to do a little bit deeper dive into the federal funds that are available to us and how those could possibly be used. So I'll, he's on. I'll mute myself.
Good. Thank you, Ms. Bailey. And Commissioner Bailey and Mr. Greenman, please identify yourself for the record and begin. Good to have you unmute yourself. Oh, there you go.
Yep, got it. Morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Greenman. I'm the budget director at the Department of Human Services. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about the federal funds that the state has been receiving and hope, you know, potentially will continue to receive. We receive under federal law, there's what's called the Child Care Development Block Grant that the state receives. And for a number of years, since the 90s, the state has been receiving in the neighborhood of around $60 million until recently. It was about $60 million a year from the Child Care Development Block Grant. And starting in federal fiscal year 2018, that was increased by about $30 million. We got additional funds through the block grant. Basically, the intent behind getting the additional funds that Congress stated was so that we would come into compliance with the Child Care Development Act, basically come into compliance with the requirements for the rates and for expanding eligibility and for the other pieces of the act. We have received the $30 million starting in federal fiscal year 18, the additional money. We received it in 19 and we received it in 20 as well. And we spent some of those dollars already to expand eligibility in the 2019 session. And I think we spent about $25 million of those dollars, which leaves us with sort of in the account in our child care development fund, we have about $65 million in funds banked, so to speak, they're banked in the fund. And are available to be used for eligible purposes, one of which would be increasing rates. In addition to that, what's unknown is how long Congress will, because Congress sets its budget on an annual basis, we don't know whether we'll continue to receive those funds. We're hopeful that we'll continue to receive them, but at this point, we don't really typically know until they pass their budget, which, as we all know, sometimes doesn't happen until partway through the year. So we know we've got $65 million in the fund that we can spend. We know that there was some additional CCDBG dollars passed on a one-time basis through the CARES Act, which was about $48 million. And I think there's discussion around how those funds should be used. And I think there's some ideas around that as well. But certainly we've got the $65 million in the bank right now that we could use for the increase.
Thank you. Are we turning things back to Ms. Commissioner Bailey? I'm not sure, or Mr. Green, are you continuing?
I think I can turn it back over to, I don't know if Ms. Bailey has more she wants to add.
I was just going to, thank you, Representative Pinto. I was just going to just reiterate that the governor's request is for the governor's proposal is setting the rates at the 30th percentile, which is above the minimum of 25%. And the reason for that is the extended length of time that we've been out of compliance. All the issues that Representative Pinto went into at the beginning in his introductory remarks about the urgent need for bringing these providers, bringing them into compliance, bringing their rates into compliance, and addressing that sort of historical inadequacy. So I wanted to put that formally out there. That is the governor's request. And then I think we were hoping to hear from Doug Berg to go through, to walk through a discussion about the tracking sheet.
Okay, thank you. I know we have a question from a member, and I'm inclined to, I think it's from Representative Pryor. Representative Pryor, is this a question you'd be helpful to ask now? I was going to hold off for a number till the end, but I don't mind if there's some clarifying questions as well. So, Representative Pryor?
I do have two questions, and I think one of my questions, it'll be more help. I think it's something that that might be covered next. But I think the first question, though, I think is part of this presentation that we just heard, if I may ask it now.
Sure, Representative Pryor.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I forget we're in committee. I know, Commissioner, you said that there's a penalty, a potential, there is a penalty out there for not coming into compliance on these rates. So could you tell us how much that penalty could be?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor. It's a little bit tricky to calculate exactly, but it depends on how the federal government ultimately decides to allocate their penalty. But from what we understand, it could be from $2.75 million to about $5.5 million. And that would go into effect after September 30th of this year. We've been on notice about this, I believe, for 3 years. And so this is something that would ultimately, we don't have any more wiggle room after September 30th, is how I understand it.
Representative Pryor, you had another question. And I will say, as I say, my general plan had been to kind of get through these presentations. Mr. Berg's going to present on fiscal aspects, and then we'll certainly have a discussion and plenty of questions. But if you have another clarifying question, Representative Pryor, go ahead.
That was the question at this point, and perhaps I'll have a question after we hear the presentation from Mr. Berg. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Members and members of the public, language in support of the administration's proposal for the 30th percentile increase was one of the items that's in our packet. I don't know that there's necessarily a need to go through the language at this point, but Ms. Bailey, was there anything further that you wanted to present regarding that proposal before we move to Mr. Berg and walk through the tracking sheet?
Mr. Chair, no, thank you. That we're ready for him to present his information. Thank you.
Okay, great. So members and members of the public, one of the items in the packet, again, for members of the public, this is on our committee website, and members sent out to you is a fiscal tracking sheet that's put together by the nonpartisan staff in the House. It's session proposal tracking. And so, Mr. Berg, if you could please walk us through that. It contains both the administration's proposal just discussed by Ms. Bailey and also the proposal that was passed through this committee during the regular session. So if you can just kind of walk us through that, members, I'd call your attention to that document. And actually, yeah, I should confirm that. And Senator Housley, so we should have that for you as well in some form, if only on the committee website. So you'll have that as well. So Mr. Berg, please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, can everybody hear me, I hope?
You can be heard. Yep.
Okay. Yes, as the chair said, there is a one-page file that was posted to the committee website that if you open it, it says at the top, child care rate proposal funding. It shows two funding displays. The top one is labeled as the CCAP maximum rate's 30th percentile, which is the level the governor recommended in his initial budget, and the lower one is labeled the 25th percentile. Just a small note on the display there. It doesn't on the top say the governor's budget recommendation because the way this is displayed is with only the $65.2 million that Mr. Greenman referred to in CCDBG funds as part of it. And the governor's has variously been displayed in his original budget and the most recent numbers I got from the department with some of the CARES Act funding in it. So I just wanted to distinguish that this is based on the department's numbers, but I have adjusted it to remove the CARES Act funding. So that's why I didn't label it as the governor's proposal, but it reflects numbers for the governor's proposal if no money other than the existing CCDBG money is used. In the case of the 25th percentile, you'll see it is labeled in parentheses as House File 4374, which the House passed at the end of the regular session in May. And this is the same numbers as that from the department. Again, however, it uses only the $65.2 million of existing CCDBG money and does not use any CARES Act funding. So I want to be clear about that. And in both cases, they are numbers after the May budget re-estimate. So they are the most recently estimated numbers. With that sort of housekeeping out of the way, in the top case, you'll see what happens is the two lines that are of most use to look at on this are the very top bold line, which shows, the very top bold line, which shows the general fund cost of the proposal, and the very bottom line, which shows the federal revenue that's used, that is the $65.2 million of federal CCDBG money. And in both cases, there is a $53,000 general fund cost reflected in fiscal year 21. That's the only, general fund cost. That's the only state cost. I'll just make a side note that we pay for the systems costs separately from the actual grant funding, the rates. We can't use the CCDBG funding to fund the systems costs. If you look at the notation there, we pay, there's a separate reimbursement with the federal government for that administrative cost where the state pays 55% of the cost and the federal government pays the rest of the cost for system funds. So that's why there's a general fund cost there, even though the cost of the rate increase is paid for with federal funds. And to compare both, you'll see that in fiscal year 21, you have the same system-only cost of $53,000. But if you go then to the bottom line in each display, you'll see at the 30th percentile, it would spend $26.4 million of the federal money we have in hand. And the 25th percentile would spend $20.4 million of that same money. Going to the tails, the cost of both proposals gets greater than the $65.2 million over 3 years. And so in fiscal year 22, in the case of the governor's proposal, there would be an expenditure of federal funds, again, on the bottom line of $38.9 million. That spends the rest of the federal money we have in hand. And if you add those 2 years, 20 and 21 together, you get $65.2 million of federal money we currently have. And the remainder of that is then picked up by the general fund, which in fiscal year 22 is $17.4 million. And in fiscal year 23, under the governor's proposal, would be an additional $69.4 million. So, and if you go down to the 25th percentile, the same methodology applies, but then you spend $44.8 million of federal money in 22. Again, if you add those two together, 21 and 22, you spend a total of $65.2 million in federal CCDBG money we have in hand. The residual state general fund cost in fiscal 22 at the 25th percentile is $1.2 million. And then in fiscal 23, again, you've exhausted the currently available CCDBG funds and have a residual general fund cost of $59.1 million. If you look on, just as a side note, the systems costs are the same for both proposals. So it's $53,000 a year in 21 and 22 and $11,023. I will just make a brief note. I suspect we're going to get into the discussion immediately of what happens with the federal CCDBG grant. This display shows only use of the existing funding, and as Mr. Greenman noted, the issue we have, and we have to recognize that the federal budget for the next fiscal year has not been completed and will likely not be completed till in recent years. Well, hopefully it would be the end of this calendar year in the fall, but in recent years it might be as late as early next year. There is a lot of consideration and debate about whether the additional funding the chair and Mr. Greenman referred to in the last three fiscal years will continue. That certainly is possible. I think there are some people who think that is likely. This display does not assume it will be there, and through a lot of discussions with Minnesota Management and Budget, we are not able to assume that money will be there, but there is certainly some idea that it may be. And if that money became available, what you can do is substitute any money we would get that is the above the standard grant. So if the $30 million roughly of additional funding continues, that would dollar for dollar reduce the state's general fund expenditure for the costs on either of these displays in this sheet. So one more year of federal funding like that would cover either proposal into fiscal year 22 without a state cost and start reaching into 23. And if in fact the next 2 years are the same as the last 3 years, then it would be enough to cover all of the costs on the 25th percentile and a substantial amount of the costs in the 30th percentile. So I know that's a fair amount of information. I think I'll stop there, Mr. Chair, and see if members have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. And I think it makes sense to, we'll take some questions and kind of see where it takes us. I've got Representative Pryor again on the list. And so Representative Pryor, I'll call on you and please ask your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Berg. And you were getting to my question right there at the end. And since we've got spreadsheets open and people that may not have access to those spreadsheets as they fumble through to find their website and all that information, you know, just to be on that track of where we, and I'm going to say the word likely to be, if this federal money continues, knowing that this money has continued over the years and that the federal government has made this commitment to child care, and at the federal level, it is a bipartisan agreement and priority to start funding the infrastructure of child care, which after we get to the other side of this pandemic will probably be more important than ever as we try to restart this economy. So, you know, the importance of what we're talking about, I don't think can be underestimated. So to review again, the if federal money continues, what does that look like in the state of Minnesota for this Black grant, and how we would be able to begin to, you know, bring up to living wages what we're paying child care workers. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor, I'm not sure I can address the very last part of your question about the wages for child care workers. I don't know if either Mr. Greenman or the Assistant Commissioner wish to weigh in on that. Again, I think the first part of your question was sort of along the lines of, do we think the last 3 years of funding are going to continue? And this is a tricky thing. As the budget person, I have to follow the way the finance department, the Minnesota Management and Budget tracks things, which at this point they recognize that we've gotten this money. There is certainly some expectation that this may be the new normal. At this point, it hasn't gone on long enough that the finance department or the Minnesota Management and Budget is comfortable counting this as the amount of money we should expect to get in the future. So that leaves budget people like Mr. Greenman and myself tracking a cost in the tails, which may be covered. It could be covered. It may not be unlikely to be covered by the federal government, but which at this point we cannot count as being covered. The upside of this, if you want to look at it, is we balance the budget in the current biennium, as members probably mostly know, it gets talked about a lot. We have to balance the budget. Constitutionally, we can't run a deficit other than for debt service purposes, things like that. But for the general fund and other funds, we have to balance the budget within the biennium. In the tails, we have no such requirement, but we do track those funds so that we have planning numbers. And so in this case, there's no cost in 2021, or other than the $53,000 in systems costs, that affects the budget. The tails, at this point, we have to find some way to account for the tails.
And so I want to dive into this just a little bit and make sure we're clear. So Mr. Berg, so a couple things. So my understanding is that, as maybe for DHS as well, is that sort of there's been a minimum of about $30 million in additional funding over the last couple of years. Per year, last couple of years. Is that, first of all, is that correct? I'm seeing Ms. Bailey nodding.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And then another understanding per Representative Pryor's question is that the funding for this program really has not gone down in the history of the program. I mean, with I think there may be one exception one year where there was an increase that was described as being temporary in advance, but otherwise sort of it's been, the funding has not gone down historically. Is that correct as well?
Mr. Chair, this is Dave Greenman from DHS. Yeah. It's remained relatively stable. There's been some small fluctuations from year to year in the past, but since fiscal year 2018, it's not gone down. That's correct. Okay. It's gone up and it's stayed up.
And then I just want to make sure I understand the spreadsheet then, that if we were to assume that $30 million each year were to continue to come, which again, historically it has, and we know there's a Trump administration commitment to this and others, that the approximately $60 million cost of the 25th percentile proposal, that $60.3 million on the right side of our spreadsheet, that would pretty much be entirely covered. And then two-thirds of the cost of the administration's proposal would be covered if the $30 million continues each year. Mr. Berg, am I saying that correctly? And
Mr. Chair, that's a correct way to view it. And I just, again, this is kind of a picayune point, but as a budget guy, each budget forecast reestimates demand. So by this November, even if everything that we think is the way it is happens the way it does, these numbers will be slightly different. So I just want to say from today's perspective, that's correct. And even though the numbers would change, some substantial portion of it, either all or a substantial part, depending on which of these proposals you're looking at, would be covered by federal funds should that level of funding for the last 3 years continue.
And then the last question on this for you all is the my understanding is that a number of other states' budget offices do in fact count the expected federal future federal dollars, is my understanding. I think North Carolina, Washington, Maryland, Utah, maybe some other ones as well. Is that consistent with your understanding as well? That in our state, we're kind of taking the more conservative approach, which seems just fine, but to recognize that some other states do, in fact, count on those dollars continuing. Does anybody have knowledge of that?
Mr. Chair, I can comment on that we're taking a conservative approach. I guess, yeah, that would be a little bit in the eye of the beholder, but it is the case that I've had extensive conversations with Minnesota Management and Budget on this, and they have sort of a twofold position, one of which is that we don't have enough experience yet to count on this money, and that generally we do not project federal grant increases forward. We count them on a year-to-year basis. I guess I can't speak to exactly what other states may be doing with this particular funding source.
Okay. And Mr. Greenwood, were you going to say something? Look like you.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I was just going to say that, you know, the matter of forecasting is complicated. We work closely with MMB. We work with the legislature, legislative staff like Mr. Berg. And anytime we, you know, work on this kind of thing, we review the issues, we essentially try to balance the likelihood of getting the additional federal funds against the risk to the budget. There's always a downside risk to the budget when you forecast something and it doesn't happen. And I think that's an important thing, and that's MMB's job, and they're looking out for that, and that's kind of the balancing act we try to play when we look at issues like these federal funds.
Thank you, Mr. Greenman. Representative Pryor, I let you. Did you have something? Have anything further right now? No. Okay. Representative Bonner, you're up next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if this is the right time to jump in, but I know we did have our friend from DHS just on. And I was curious about what was the plan, what is the plan that we would do with the $65 million in CCDBG funds if they're not put towards the rate increases for our providers?
And Ms. Bailey or Mr. Greenman? Ms. Bailey.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not sure who asked that question.
Representative Bonner.
I'm sorry. If that's something that happens, we would consult with our stakeholders essentially to look at other ways that those funds could be used that support the goals of the child care assistance program. So there are, you know, multiple different things we could do. We would do some outreach and come up with an alternate proposal.
Representative Bonner, anything further? No? Okay. Oh, Representative Bonner, we need to have you on mute. Sorry. Thank you. Try that again. There you go.
Sorry. Thank you, Ms. Bailey. Certainly, I'm curious about more of what that might look like, although I think the preference is obviously that we would prefer that that money go directly to providers. We know that they are doing some of the most fundamental work caring for our earliest learners in a stage in which they need the most assistance in becoming and forming into those wonderful little individuals that they are, and certainly getting them off to a good start. So making sure we have good teachers that are well paid and ready for the task is certainly where I would prefer to see the money. But I do appreciate your response and helping us understand what would be the alternative if it did not go to the providers. But thank you for that. I appreciate the clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. And Ms. Bailey, is there anything further you can give? I mean, it's a pretty substantial amount of money, and I think I'm so hopeful that we can make this rate increase happen. If we didn't, and can you give us any better sense as to what happens with that $65
million? Mr. Chair, I think what I'm going to do at this point is defer to my colleague, Lori Pussine, who's the director of the Child Care Assistance Program, and she's online and she can speak to some of the options. I believe 70% of that is obligated to go to supporting low-income children, and I'm just going to ask for her to confirm that and speak to some other options.
Thank you. Ms. Pocin, please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee and Senator Housley. I am Lori Pocin, the manager of the Child Care Assistance Program with the Department of Human Services. Yes, there is a requirement for the majority of this, the 70% of the funds to be directed towards direct services, and low-income families are the priorities. And by low-income families in federal law, it's up to 85% of the state median income. So there would likely need to be some commitment towards serving families. Basic sliding fee investments are often a way to do that, in addition to other grants or supports in combination with what we do to support providers. And then there's a three-year window for spending or obligating to and spending. So, there would need to be scenarios laid out that would accomplish that within those windows of time.
Okay. It sounds like there need to be you go through a process and have to figure out kind of what to do with it. I'm gathering. Okay. Other questions for members? Okay, thank you. And I do want to follow up on a question as I'm waiting for that. Representative Pryor had asked earlier about the penalty. Can you remind us again of the timing of that? I believe that could potentially be in September. I think we're one of only a few states that is in fact out of compliance in this way or in corrective action. What's kind of the schedule for that?
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Bailey.
Thank you. We've been on notice of this impending penalty for some time in order to give the state time to come into compliance. But the final date is, as I understand it, September 30th of 2020, and then it would be imposed after that date. I don't know, Mr. Greenman, maybe could speak to when it needs to be paid by, but that would be this fall.
Mr. Greenman, if you have anything to add.
Mr. Chair, no, I don't have anything to add. I think it's something we would have to pay. There's uncertainty, as Ms. Bailey said, about how much it would be, but it would have to, I believe it would have to be paid this fall.
And Mr. Greenman, where does that, I mean, that money presumably comes out of the general fund. Like basically we're writing a check from the state of Minnesota to the United States and just handing over several million dollars because we're failing to support our children and providers. And am I summarizing that accurately?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think it would either be a direct payment by the state to the federal government, or it would be achieved through a reduction in future child care development block grant funds.
Okay. And a clarification about Ms. Pocin's point about what the $65 million could be used for. You mentioned that it could go to basic sliding fee. But that would require legislative action. Is that correct? And could you put some of these funds to work for low-income families without further legislative action? So I guess that's another concern that I have, imagining if we didn't do this with that funding.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe, I believe we have a waiting list right now with the Basic Sliding Fee Program, and I don't believe we're required to have a waiting list. I think the department could put some money towards I think that would be one option. I don't know that we would need legislation to do that.
Okay. And members and Senator Housley as well, reminder that if you have questions, please indicate that, raise your hand and otherwise. I want to ask, and I may end up calling on you, Representative France, and in respect to this, so just a heads up, that there's Representative Franson had a proposal that came in the form of an amendment that the rate increase would be made contingent on federal funding being available, and so that state funding would not go to that. And I guess I want to ask about that. Representative Franson, is there anything that you, since this, I've invoked you, anything that you want to say about that? And then I'm going to have a couple questions myself about it.
I guess just we are in a recession of some sort due to the forced shutdown of businesses. Tax dollars aren't coming in. We, as of right now, we know that we are about $2.5 billion in negative deficit. We do not know what the November forecast will look like. Also, due to the fraud in the system, and we know that there is fraud, taxpayers still are very wary of putting additional state dollars into a program that we still are not sure if those state dollars are being used in the way that they are intended to do so. I think taxpayers would feel a lot better if just the federal funds were used, because we have to use those or be penalized. But at this time, I and my colleagues do not feel comfortable putting in additional dollars into the program when A, we don't know if integrity is in the program, and B, we are in a major deficit.
And thank you. And I have a couple of questions for our presenters. I guess I do want to remind all of us regarding integrity in the program that we've received a number of presentations and did a ton last year, and then of course have done a lot since then as well. But I know this is an ongoing conversation about that. But I wanted to ask, I guess this is a twofold question. One, if folks from the department can just comment on kind of the, in your view, the wisdom and the propriety of the of having such a contingency, kind of what the effect would be on the program for families and providers and others, if you could comment on that. And Ms. Bailey.
Mr. Chair, thank you. In thinking about this, we think that the contingency language would bring us into compliance. We would be in compliance with that contingency language. In other words, it does bring risk. We just don't have enough of a track record yet to know exactly how long this additional federal funds is going to continue coming, or if it's going to continue coming. If the federal funds are not available, and then therefore the rates would drop back down immediately, that would immediately put us out of compliance. So yeah, it's a risk, a significant risk we see it as in terms of compliance, and also for just for providers and knowing, having that assurance and knowing what's available to them. So we do believe it would bring us into the language itself would bring us into compliance, but not without risk.
And can you just maybe comment a little more about the risk, the impact on families from that? Because I guess I'm imagining, and providers as well, you do this increase, but then knowing that in the future it may well go back down, and just kind of the sense of instability and uncertainty. Any further comments about that, or maybe I don't know if Ms. Pacine or otherwise, or you, Ms. Bailey?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll just briefly comment and then ask Ms. Pocine. Because the federal government budgeting is on an annual basis, and of course our legislative session is not necessarily aligned with the federal budgeting process. Anytime, as soon as the federal government announces that they're not, those funds are not available to the state, therefore, with the contingency language, as I understand it, then we would be immediately out of compliance. It's just something that providers wouldn't be able to plan on and know for the future as far as what, you know, what their income is going to be. Just like any other business owners, they're competing and, you know, need that assurance. So I'll just allow Ms. Pocine to add to that. She's even closer than I am on this issue.
Yes. Yes, members, Chair and Senator, what we've been hearing from providers is that just like any business, but even more maybe imperative for childcare providers, especially in this climate, is that they need to plan 2 years ahead, at least in a business cycle, to know what space they should be committing to. Their capacities for children are constantly changing. They commit to products and services that go along with staffing commitments. And so their projections include all their possible revenues, and they can't turn on a dime. And that's the thing that we're seeing now in the climate that we're in, is more uncertainty is just going to make more unstable provision, the ability to provide services for families.
And so if I'm summarizing right, and please correct me if this is wrong, but it sounds like you're saying collectively that it may well put us in compliance, at least in the time period the rates are up. That doesn't mean it's a good idea. Is that from the perspective of the administration? Is that correct, Ms. Bailey?
Mr. Chair, I think I'll just leave it at that. It poses a significant risk, and we don't see it as something that would be beneficial for the providers, who are the very people we're trying to support at this time.
Probably some challenges for families too. I thank
you. Families, of course, yes.
Representative Katiza Witoon, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm kind of given in the same vein, consistency for our providers. I'm curious, given that Minnesota is one of the few states who remain out of compliance with this, I'm wondering if there is have been any conversations, or if we have any idea or feeling how long this 25th percentile requirement would remain in place as opposed to a higher level, if we're anticipating that another change might come down from the federal government in order to further boost the levels for our providers here in Minnesota and across the country.
Ms. Bailey or Mr. Newman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patiza, that's not something we just don't know. The answer is we just don't know. Every year is something new, and we don't have any reason to believe it will go up immediately, but it's certainly possible.
Thank you.
There's, when I've been speaking to folks across the country, they're just kind of shocked that we're at the 25th percentile as it is, and that the idea is 25th percentile in 2011 rates is just kind of amazing. I don't know if you all have any further comparisons in terms of what it is with other states, Ms. Bailey or Ms. Pocine, perhaps. I don't know if you have any further knowledge on that.
Mr. Chair, I don't have any on the other states. I was surprised to find out just last night that back in 2001, I believe, Minnesota was at the 75th percentile. And the rates have just, for various reasons, and there are lots of different things going on, but just to give some context, this is not historically, I think we're at a low.
Okay. And again, if there's other member questions or Senator Housley, please indicate. I've got at least one more, I guess I'll ask, because I'm waiting to see if anybody else does. If the rate increase were to be made different for different providers, my understanding is you kind of need to treat different classes of providers similarly in the rate increase. And so treating any change that would treat them differently, that would put us out of federal compliance. Am I right about that, Ms. Bailey?
Mr. Chair, you are. That would immediately put us out of compliance. They has to be uniform across all the providers.
Okay. Representative Bonner has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to our testifiers. So I guess I've been, you know, processing all of what we've been talking about, but one of the points that I haven't heard a lot about is, I mean, one, I know we talked about that we've been sort of on notice for the last 3 years that we needed to get into compliance or we would be penalized, right? So we'd be spending $1 million in penalties come September. But the reality is, you know, we also know we've actually been out of compliance, as some folks have mentioned, for almost 9 years, really, because we're working on figures from 2011 rather than current figures, right? So, and so we're not adequately paying our providers in that sense. But the other really critical piece that really hasn't been discussed here is that, you know, childcare providers, when the pandemic hit, stepped up. They took care of all our essential workers. They took care of those children. They made sure that those essential workers could get to work. And sometimes at great peril to their own financial well-being. And I know I have providers who are close personal friends who have found ways to make that work. But it's certainly challenging. And as we talk about reopening the economy and people going back to work, childcare is essential, not just as it always was, but more so than ever, in that in order for people to go back to work, we need to have these childcare providers taken care of. And I guess the fact that we're still arguing over rates 9 years later, I get that we're in a pandemic. I get all of these things, but in an odd way, it makes the need for this to happen more relevant than ever before. And I guess I'm just frustrated that we are still having this discussion 9 years later. And in a pandemic where we need these folks to come to bat for us and help us reopen the economy and get things back up and running, get our revenues regenerated, I think that just makes sense. And not only that, in a pandemic, when we're talking about being short on funds, do we really want to spend $1 million on a penalty because we didn't do the right thing for 9 years? I think that is not adequate. And I really hope that we can do better in that regard. The other thing I would mention is that, you know, we talked about what would happen down the road if we were to rely on federal funds. Now, in all likelihood, we will have them if the trend continues. But if we don't, you know, it seems crazy that we would be not making the investment in our youngest learners and our providers who are giving that care in the most formative years of their life. And not to mention, you know, I feel like if we're making that commitment to them, in order for them to plan and to be solvent for years to come, we need to make sure that we're giving them that peace of mind. And so I guess that's just where my thought is at, and wanted to say so. I appreciate the time, Mr. Chair, for being able to step up and ask that.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. A reminder to folks, I think the penalty is in the range of 3 to 5 million, but it's significant and really critical. And thank you, Representative Bonner, for raising that. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Heintzman, we're having you're very low volume. Try again.
Is that any better, Mr. Chair?
Boy, it's pretty rough. At least for me, it is.
Not sure what else I can do.
That's maybe a tiny bit better. You may need to talk pretty loud, and we'll all try to stay pretty quiet.
We'll try this.
That's much better. We can hear you.
Okay. You know, I heard over the course of the last few minutes, and I have more of a comment really than anything else. I apologize. I don't recall who said it, but we're talking about previously Representative Franzen's amendment, and you asked for comment from some of the folks at the agency. And one of the things that stood out to me is the idea that, and I guess maybe an idea is the wrong way to put it, but the comment that the folks involved in this process, they need to plan for 2 years ahead, which I completely agree. In a perfect world, we would absolutely love that everybody could expect and have certainty in their business or in their community budget or whatever those scenarios might be. But that's unfortunately impossible. Although government could intervene and create certainty, the folks providing the revenues, the taxpayer, they don't face certainty. And it's very nice that some folks in government could create that scenario, but the people footing the bill, the taxpayer, do not. And I don't know that anybody's speaking for them right now. It sounds like a lot of flowery speeches. That's nice, talking about the needs, and I get that. We need to do absolutely everything we can within our means to provide for those needs. But we're simply talking about making sure that if the federal funds weren't available, that the Minnesota taxpayer isn't on the hook, who is facing uncertainty on, at this point, even almost a daily basis. This governor has shut down Minnesota's economy, unlike many states in our region. And I don't know about your districts around the state, but in mine, I'm getting daily calls from businesses who are filing bankruptcy. So I think it's a very insensitive conversation to be having right now that we would even suggest that while the taxpayer is facing uncertainty, that we have to provide 2 years of certainty at taxpayer expense. We have to at least be considering those folks, and I don't know that anybody has spoken up for them today.
Thank you, Representative Heintzman. And I made a reminder that what we're talking about is a situation where families don't have care, then the parents don't, then they can't work, then we can't have hiring, then the economy grinds to a halt, and we're in a really difficult situation. I feel like that's what we've seen in the pandemic.
Mr. Chair, follow-up, please.
Yeah. Representative Heintzman, please, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A reminder that we are talking about taxpayer dollars. Taxpayers who have faced and are facing a crisis in many cases like they never have before. A reminder, members.
Thank you, Representative Heintzman. I believe I had somebody with a question. My apologies here. Representative Pryor, please. We need to unmute you. There we go.
There we are. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I think this is a good part of the discussion, and I appreciate, you know, this morning where we can talk about these things, because, again, what we're talking about is underlying this, what taxpayers want us to do, and taxpayers want us to, want government to provide the basic services and goods that keep the economy going. I mean, you can't work if you don't have roads to get there. There's so many parts to our infrastructures that are critical to the economy. And if we bail on this one, which is the infrastructure, which we've all agreed to, that childcare and providing quality care for our children as their parents work, it's our future because it's education, and that's a core part of our responsibility as government. And also the health of our community, because we also, you know, we go back to the very beginning of this committee where we talked about brain development. And if we bail on that responsibility to make sure that all kids get a great start, we've bailed on our future. So I think this is the critical discussion that taxpayers want us to have, is how to use our resources in a way that meets today's needs and builds for tomorrow. So, you know, I appreciate raising that as an issue, Representative Heintzman. And I think that it's great that we're having this discussion.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that said about taxpayers expect us to provide the basic function, you know, taxpayers expected to be allowed to keep their jobs without government interfering with their income. I mean, we've got, as Representative Heintzman said, we have individuals that don't know how they're going to make it to the next day, how they're going to be able to keep their businesses and keep their employees employed. And so, Mr. Chair, I mean, this is a reality that needs to be faced. I mean, we just cannot be spending tax additional state dollars. I would rather us be prudent, be conservative in our approach, because what I do not want us to be in next year's budget cycle is into a position where we have to cut back the child care assistance program. And that, Mr. Chair, would be a tragedy for us to be put in, because let's face it, next year's budget is not going to be pretty. Nobody's going to want to be cutting, but cuts are going to have to happen. And so, Mr. Chair and members, taxpayers are the ones that are funding the child care assistance program. Taxpayers right now have no money.
Representative Katiza Witoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks everybody for your comments. I think this is just, it is such an important discussion to be having, and given that our economy has ground to a halt because of the COVID-19 pandemic, and making sure that our citizens are staying safe and healthy and we are moving forward as best we can, I think that when taxpayers are contributing to something like the CCAP program, it's in our best interest in general to ensure that we're not wasting their money by paying fees to the federal government because we are out of compliance with the program, being one of the very few states in the union that is not towing the line. And I think that, especially considering the fact that parents are unable to work or to go back to work if they don't have childcare for their children, and if they are having some financial difficulties, accessing the child care assistance program is something that could bring benefit to them, that funding this program is exceedingly important and it's going to continue to be. So I just want to make sure that we're kind of paying attention to those couple items.
Thank you. I had mentioned at the very start of this that Senator Housley was joining us, and I know she's been listening in on this, et cetera, and want to give her a chance to either ask any questions or say anything that she wishes. And so, Senator, so glad to have you here. So please proceed.
Thank you, Representative Pinto and members, for allowing me to sit here and listen in. It's a complicated issue. You've heard both sides of it. Same conversations are happening over in the Senate. We wish there was some way there could be a compromise to figure it out. So it's that the taxpayers are having some assurances that this isn't coming out of their pocketbook to a program that has a history of, we don't need to go into the history, but so we'll have to talk offline about this, Representative Pinto, to see what we can do. Is it the friends and amendment that would work that I could sell to my caucus? Definitely hearing from all the child care providers and the families, but I'm also hearing from my constituents who, right, have no guarantee about their own job or their business tomorrow. So we'll have to continue this discussion. I know Senator Abler has been working on it for years, trying to figure out how we can get that $65 million into the hands of those providers and families. But thank you again. Thank you to the department and all the members for letting me be a part of this today. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator Housley. Members, are there any other questions for our presenters? I know this is going to, again, the informational hearing, there will be continued discussion, I know, but anything further from anyone? Just making absolutely sure. Okay, I'm good. Well, really thank our presenters for joining us, and Senator Housley, to you as well. And members, again, and members of the public, this is a really, really critical issue. It's essential to make progress on this, and I'll be eager to work with everyone, as I know you all will be, to make it happen. So thanks so much. Have a great rest of the morning. With that, the hearing is adjourned.